Hi, good morning, family. This morning's scripture comes from the book of Lamentations, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, and Jeremiah, the 29th chapter, verses 4 through 7. I'll start with Lamentations. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, there is no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. After affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. She dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. And from Jeremiah, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there to not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. Okay, just checking the mic. That was my test. I'm Angie Cho, one of the elders here at WCF. This morning we have the distinct privilege of welcoming Reverend Dr. Soonchan Ra as our guest preacher. Dr. Ra is the Robert B. Munger Professor of Evangelism at Fuller Theological Seminary and a widely respected voice in the church today. He's the author of several influential books, including The Next Evangelicalism and Prophetic Lament, and a co-author of Unsettling Truths, written with DC native Mark Charles, who I think a lot of us have had interaction with, a powerful examination of the church's complicity in historic injustice. Dr. Ra also recently contributed to the book Abortion Abolition, Beyond Pro-Life and Pro-Choice Politics, alongside our own Pastor Andrew, with whom he serves on the board of Evangelicals for Justice. And in case you were wondering, yes, he also makes a mean Korean barbecue short rib, which Pastor Andrew can personally vouch for, and I personally cannot yet. So please join me in welcoming Reverend Dr. Soonchan Ra.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So I actually grew up in this area. I grew up a little bit north of here, first in inner city Baltimore, and then I moved to Columbia, Maryland, and worked in DC for a number of years as well at the Department of Energy back in my government bureaucrat years. And so it's good to be back home. I still have family that live in this area, so I still feel a great deal of fondness for this area and for this community. I want to begin by telling you a story, and the story has to do with my age. I am 57 years old. Turn to your neighbor and says, he does not look 57 at all. Go ahead, do that. He does not look 57 at all. You've heard the phrase, black don't crack? New phrase, Asian don't raisin. This is absolutely true. We Asians age very gracefully. And Pastor Andrew is actually 104 years old. I don't know if he knew that, but he actually is aging very gracefully. But like many of you who are kind of in that age where you're starting to worry a little bit about your health and maybe your physical fitness, so I've done this almost every year that I've hit a landmark birthday. So when I hit 30, when I hit 40, but certainly when I hit 50, I said, this is it. This is the decade I'm going to get serious about my health. This is the decade I'm going to really concentrate on physical fitness. So I'm an academic, I'm a researcher, so I said, I'm going to research this topic of how do I keep fit? Now, you know, I use the number one tool that academics use. It's called Google. You might have heard of this. So I go on Google and I type in, how does a 50-year-old stay fit? And out popped the answer. And it's, believe it or not, something called CrossFit. How many of you have heard of this? CrossFit? Yeah, I don't do it. I just read about it. But CrossFit apparently uses a mode of exercise and an approach, a philosophy. And the philosophy is called muscle confusion. Have you heard of this? Muscle confusion is the underlying philosophy of CrossFit. And when I read that, I said, that's perfect, because that's been my approach to exercise my entire life. And the way I apply it is I don't go to the gym for months. And when I go to the gym, my muscles are really confused why we are there, and they get hard and angry. So that's my approach to exercise. And I realized as I was reading through some of this material on physical fitness and physical well-being that sometimes confusion or disruption is not a bad thing. So if you're a couch potato, it's okay to disrupt that with the discomfort of going to the gym to exercise. And I began to ask that question, if it's true for our physical fitness and well-being, could it also be true for our spiritual well-being? That sometimes we get into a status quo where we're comfortable with where we are in our spiritual lives and all these kind of things in our lives, and what we really need is disruption, dis-ease, discomfort. And I began to ask that question about how is the church doing at introducing disruption and discomfort into our lives. So I looked at the concept of worship, and if you want to turn to slide two there, when you look at worship in the typical American church, and this is a study, three different studies I want to talk about the typical American church. And the first study was done on churches that use liturgical worship. So this is the Catholic, the Episcopalian, Lutheran, some Methodists. They are guided by certain liturgies. And in fact, there's a book that guides them. You should preach on this passage on this Sunday. You should focus on these psalms on this Sunday or sing these hymns. So the attempt there is to integrate kind of the whole breadth of scripture through the liturgy and through a cycle of liturgy. And it turned out, according to Denise Hopkins, who teaches right down the street here or taught right down the street here at Wesley Seminary, Denise Hopkins noted that many of the liturgical traditions, when they got time to preach on lament or read a psalm of lament or sing a hymn of lament, they just dropped it and replaced it with happier passages of scripture or happier hymns or happier psalms. Then they did a study on hymnals, and mostly focused on Presbyterian and Baptist hymnals, and said, when you look at a typical hymnal, what's the percentage of those that are reflecting lament, and what are the percentage that reflects celebration? Now, if you look at the Psalms, which is the what we would call the kind of the hymnal for the Jewish people in the Old Testament, if you look at the Psalms, you'll find that about 60% of the Psalms are Psalms of celebration, victory, triumph. Let's get up and dance, for the Lord is good. But 40% of the Psalms are Psalms of what we call lament, acknowledging suffering and pain that is in the world. But if you look at a typical Baptist and Presbyterian hymnal, you'll find that 80 to 85% of our hymns are hymns of celebration, victory, triumph, and only 15, 20% of the hymns are hymns of lament and suffering. And again, that's just what's in the hymnals, not even what's sung typically. So the third study was something that I did, and I looked at contemporary Christian worship music. And there's something called CCLI, Contemporary Christian Licensing Incorporated, that licenses all the music that's not in your hymnals. It's the praise choruses that we sing at church. And they actually keep a very accurate list. They give you a little licensing number, and they ask that you tell them what songs you sing. Why? Because that's how they distribute the royalties to the artists that write these songs. So every time you sing a contemporary Christian worship song, an angel gets his wings, but also, you know, an artist gets 15 cents, something like that. So they have to keep a very accurate record. In fact, sometime this month, in August, they release a yearly account of what are the most popular contemporary worship songs that are sung in your typical American church. So I went through and looked at every lyric of every song of the top 100. I'm sorry, I made my TA go through every lyric of every, that's what they're for. Every lyric, I checked his work. We discovered that there's a percentage of these top 100 songs that are songs of lament or songs of celebration. And the number's right up there. But 90 to 95% of the songs are songs of celebration, victory, triumph, we're going to conquer the world, and only about 5 to 10% of those popular songs are songs of lament, pain, and struggle. So the question I begin to ask is, what happens when the church doesn't know how to lament? When the church doesn't know how to engage with the pain and suffering that is in our communities, but certainly in our neighborhoods and certainly in our nation. And what it does is it disconnects us from God's sense of justice and injustice in the world. Because if you don't lament, you don't acknowledge the presence of injustice. You don't acknowledge the presence of pain and suffering. You can ignore what is going on in the world because the community fails to lament. And that's why I wrote a book on Lamentations, the Book of Lamentations, several years ago. And of course, you know, if I'd written a book on Romans or Ephesians, I would have sold, you know, tens of thousands of copies. I think I sold 5 copies of this book because who wants to read a book about lament? Well, not the American Christian Church, because it's not a part of our practice. It's not a part of what we do. So I want to introduce you to this very important spiritual discipline of lament through the Book of Lamentations. We're going to go to Lamentations chapter 1, verse 1. It was already read to you. I just want to kind of point out some of the highlights. One of the things to note is that Lamentations is written. The first 3 verses gives us the context of why the Book of Lamentations needed to be written. The first thing that we realize is that Israel had once been a great nation, and now was, as you see the words, deserted like a widow, had now become a slave. So Israel is personified by the capital city of Jerusalem, and they're talking about Jerusalem here, which is the last remaining city for the once great nation of Israel. Now is down to one city that is under siege by the Babylonians. They're about to fall. So there is this kind of sense that we were once a great nation, Israel, and now all that's left is this capital city of Jerusalem, which is about to be devastated and destroyed by the Babylonians. So there's this kind of sense of, remember back when we were great. How can we make Israel great again? Because we remember when Israel was great. And there's a nostalgia about that greatness. And what it does, instead of leading to let's fix it, it leads to lament. There's a big difference of how Israel is responding to the brokenness in the world. They're not saying, we are going to use our human strength to fix this problem by stacking the Supreme Court, by electing the right officials. That's not the way that Israel is approaching this. They're recognizing the world is broken. We need to call upon God. We're not going to go out and fix it for ourselves. We're going to lament together, and out of that lament will come the actions that we need. And so we're seeing here in Lamentations chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, the context of a broken people crying out to God, God, we can't do this without you. Which I would say is right now the problem of the United States, where we're trying to fix the problems without God. We claim God, we name God, and we pretend God is the reason we're doing it, but ultimately we're trying to fix the problems for ourselves. Verse 2 says that bitterly she weeps at night, the nation of Israel, the person of Jerusalem. Bitterly she weeps at night, tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, there is no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her, they have become her enemies. Verse 3, after affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. Exile, by the way, as many of you know, is the absolute ultimate worst punishment for the people of God. It meant that they were no longer God's chosen people, or that's how they felt. It meant that they were no longer in their homeland. That was the gift of God to acknowledge that this is their chosen land. All of that was taken away. So when we encounter the people of God in the Book of Lamentations, the first 3 verses tells us that this is the lowest moment in Israel's history. You can't get worse than where they are right now. They've lost their home, they're in exile, their city is in shambles and in ruins. And so the temptation at this point is to run away and hide and give up and say, we want nothing to do with the world anymore because the world has defeated us. We want nothing to do with God anymore because God is no longer on our side. The temptation for God's people in the midst of suffering was to run away and hide. And that's why Jeremiah writes to the people of God, to all those I carried into exile, build houses and settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you. So what's happening here? Israel is broken. Israel is lost. They are surrounded by brokenness. They've lost their identity, and they're about to give up. And Jeremiah the prophet says, that is not something you're allowed to do. You are not allowed to run away and hide. Now, my background, my doctoral work, as well as my master's degree work, is in the area of history, church history. And one of the things I trace is, how has the church responded to times of crisis? There's kind of two ways, and I'm going to talk about one versus the other. One way is to say, we're going to go out and fix this for ourselves. And that has actually oftentimes led to massive dysfunction, where the church takes over the government and creates actually worse governance than when the church was not governing. That's when you get the Crusades. That's when you get the Inquisition. That's when you get with, what's that wonderful series, Handmaid's Tale. So you're seeing all these examples of when the church takes over, when they say, we're going to fix this for ourselves, you get a lot of dysfunction. But the other problem is oftentimes the church runs away and hides and say, we want to have nothing to do with the world that is broken. We give up on the world. In fact, this happened about 100 years ago when the church was seeing all this brokenness in the world around them and decided to run away and hide. And one of the ways that this was evidenced in our society was through architecture. And in the 1920s forward, all the way through the 1970s, a lot of churches were being built, and they had a sanctuary that looked like this. This building is a little bit different because I think because of the surrounding area, but how many of you have seen sanctuaries that look like this? Very common. If the church was built in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way up to about 1980, this was the most common form of architecture. You'll see kind of the slanted roof, a little bit of an arch on the side. You can see the buttressing here on the side. Now, I was about 8 years old, and I'm at a church here in D.C., in the D.C. area, where we were building, we had just built this sanctuary to look like this. I walk into the building, it was about January, February, it was really a cold day. I walk in, and as an eight-year-old, I say, this is the stupidest building I have ever seen in my life. As an eight-year-old, I knew right away, this is so stupid. Why? Because in a cold weather state, or when it gets cold, what happens to the heat? The heating vents run along the floor. Where does all that warm air go? Right up into the rafters, right? And so you literally have the frozen chosen on the ground and all that warm air up there. And what do you need to do? You build ceiling fans to push down the warm air, and the Pentecostals won't come to your church because they keep hitting their hands on the ceiling fans when they raise their hands for worship. So you're talking about an extraordinarily inefficient kind of a way of doing a sanctuary. So I'm sitting there as an eight-year-old saying, this is stupid. Whose stupid idea was this? The senior pastor gets up there and says, it was my idea to build the church building to look like this. And he says, I want you to imagine the entire church building turned upside down. We go to the next slide. And he says, what are you looking at when this church building is turned upside down? And he said, you're looking at the bottom of a ship. You're looking at a very big boat. Now, where in the Bible do you read about a very big boat? Noah's Ark. Exactly, Noah's Ark. And so the image that we began to form about the church is one, you either take over the world or you run away and hide from the world. You hide in Noah's Ark. Now, how do you do evangelism from an ark? Very badly, very poorly. Uncle Joe floats by, you throw out your one life preserver and you bring Uncle Joe into the ark. But if your neighbor floats by, you're a little more hesitant about bringing him into the ark because he borrowed your mower and never returned it. So yeah, is he really going to fit in on this ark? Or, you know, he looks different and his culture is different and his background is different. His socioeconomic class is different. So I'm not sure he's going to fit onto our ark. And sadly, that's one of the things that have happened over the last 100 years where there's been increasing division along racial, class, and ethnic lines, because we all want to be safe in our Noah's Arks. So we've run away and hid from the world rather than actually being a part of the world and serving the world. We've run away and hid. So what does lament mean? Lament means we see the brokenness that is in the world and we say, we're not going to run away and hide. We're going to offer up a lament on behalf of and with and for the world. Lament is the appropriate liturgical, theological, ecclesial, worship, spiritual response to the reality of suffering and pain that is in the world. Our temptation will be to go fix it with our power. Our temptation will be to run away and hide. But the biblical response is, how do we cry out on behalf of the broken that is in the world. So I want to offer this in closing. One of the ways that we do this is by taking the example from the Book of Lamentations. And one of the questions I wrote when I was grappling with when I wrote the book was, who wrote the Book of Lamentations? This is a very important theological implication, because there were big questions about who wrote the Book of Lamentations. Historically, as many of you may know, the Book of Lamentations was attributed to a prophet by the name of Jeremiah, and that's why we read Jeremiah. And it makes sense. If you know the history, when the exile occurred, they took away all the literate people. Prophets, priests, kings were sent away into exile. The ones that were left behind in Jerusalem, it was not a total exile. The ones who were left behind were the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and the sick. Those who Babylon deemed as unworthy of helping to make Babylon great, they said, we're going to leave these people in Jerusalem. They can never rebuild Jerusalem. So no literate person was actually left behind in Jerusalem that we know of. So who wrote the Book of Lamentations? It was clearly written by a literate person in Jerusalem. But we do know historically that there was one person, maybe the only person that was literate, and that was the prophet Jeremiah. If you look at the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah writes repeatedly, the Babylonians are the hand of God. They're coming to judge us rightly. And so the Babylonians thought Jeremiah was on their side. So he was not taken away to exile. He was left behind. In fact, he was probably the only literate person in the city of Jerusalem at that time. And so the only candidate to have written a book like Lamentations would have been the prophet Jeremiah. But here's the problem. We have a book called Jeremiah, and so we know how Jeremiah writes. And if you compare the book of Jeremiah to the book of Lamentations, it is completely different styles of writing. The way I describe it is Jeremiah is Shakespeare, Lamentation is Kendrick Lamar. I always have to gauge an audience to see if this is the right place for a Kendrick Lamar joke. Maybe not. Bob Dylan? All right, well, let's go with Kendrick. So Shakespeare is art. And it's kind of old style of writing, and it's clearly written by someone who knows the language well. Now, Kendrick is also phenomenal writing. It's just slightly different from Shakespeare. By the way, only of the two, only one of them has a Pulitzer in writing, and that's Kendrick. And only one of them killed it at the Super Bowl. Again, Kendrick, not Shakespeare. So you've got these two styles of writing that are clearly distinct and different from each other. So how do you reconcile that? Two different people seem to be writing the same name on both things. So the way I distinguish is, imagine after the exile, all the literate have been taken away. Jeremiah is the only literate person remaining. They gather at the town square, and out comes the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, the blind, the sick. All those Babylon had said, we want nothing to do with you. You're weak. There's nothing you can do. And they come to the city square, and they start telling their stories. Now, Jeremiah, as the learned prophet, the voice of God, he could, at that moment, step in and say, hey, let me take over this meeting. But he doesn't. He instead steps back, sits in the back, and listens while the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, their voices are raised up, and Jeremiah writes down their words. That's why if we read through the book of Lamentations, I argue it is the most feminine book of the Bible, because it's really the widows that are speaking out the loudest. It's the women whose voices are heard. And if there's anything you can learn about the book of Lamentations, listen to women. Listen to women, especially when there are moments of crisis and struggle and pain. The women's voices need to be raised up and heard. And that's what's happening in the book of Lamentations. It's not the learned, educated prophet. It is instead the voices of the women that rise up. I really learned about this as I'm writing this book, and as I'm going through this, when I began to teach in a prison. And when I was at the faculty of North Park Seminary, which is in Chicago, we began to do some work in Stateville Correctional Center, which is the supermax prison that is about an hour and a half outside of the city. As many of you know, the kind of the maximum security prisons are usually an hour outside of the city, not necessarily the city themselves. So our school initiated a master's degree program to go to the max security prison to do master's level programs for the inside students, as we call them. We never call them prisoners or incarcerated. We call them inside students, because that's what they were. They were students who happened to be inside these walls. Now, I remember the first day I was asked to go and start teaching this class, I was very nervous. I am a short, pudgy, Asian American who looks younger for his age, but I'm still not quite a physical specimen in terms of, you know, physical, you know, prowess. So I'm walking in there as someone who's relatively short, who's, you know, out of shape because I didn't do CrossFit. So I walk in there and they make you go through the whole thing. And it's pretty devastating to walk through with the bars are closing behind you. And I'm walking in the class and I realize that everybody in that class, mostly black and brown bodies, as many of you know, that's who our prisons tend to incarcerate, mostly much taller than me, 6 foot, 6 foot four. They got a lot of time on their hands, so they work out a lot. So they are buff and cut. And I'm this, again, pudgy Asian, walking into this classroom. I said, how can I control this classroom? It's certainly not my physical prowess. It's got to be my intellectual prowess. So I lay it on thick that first day of class. I'm talking about, I'm a two-time Ivy League graduate. I have my doctorate from Duke. I have my two master's degrees, two doctorate degrees. I've written these books that have won awards. I'm tenured. All of this stuff. I go on for like maybe half an hour talking about all of my credentials. Now, to their credit, these dear brothers and who were there were like, all right, it's all right, Doc. You go. And they accepted me. And they were very kind and gracious as I kind of bragged about all the things that I'd accomplished. And so I maintained that control for about 7, 8, maybe 9 weeks. And I was able to kind of assert my authority and my intellectual prowess over that classroom for the first 2/3 of that class. But at about the week 8, 9 mark, some stuff that was happening in my life that was just absolutely crushing. My son, who was in high school at the time, was getting suspended constantly because of his issues around ADHD and anxiety, depression. If I were to say it, if there's a pandemic that we're still dealing with that is still widespread, it is the anxiety, depression pandemic among our young people. It is off the charts. And my son, because of that, didn't know how to cope with it, was getting suspended kind of all the time. My daughter, who was a student at Pepperdine, it was around the time that there were the California wildfires that had pretty much burnt out the whole neighborhood that she was living in. This happens every 8-10 years. It's kind of a cycle of wildfires, and this was the last cycle. And so she was calling me in the middle of the night, saying, Dad, there's fire, flames coming down the mountains towards this campus. And my marriage was falling apart. And my mom was dying, who had been my spiritual rock. Everything that you can think of, like the worst thing that could happen to you, was happening during that kind of 3-4 week time period. So I went into the class just completely crushed, with like no strength left in me. And all that facade of strength, of intellectual capacity, of being in charge, completely went out the window. And I remember I was standing in lecture, but I just collapsed in a chair. I said, I can't do this. And I remember Cordell Cole, 6'4". 225 pounds, absolutely ripped. Tattoos all over his body, gold teeth. He was a former gang member from the south side of Chicago. He comes over, and while I'm kind of weeping at my chair, he comes over, wraps his arms around me, and he says, I'm going to get in trouble for what I'm about to do, but I really think you need this. And he hugged me, held me close, and just let me cry in his arms. Now, at that moment, we're not talking about the Ivy League educated tenured professor and the gang leader from the south side of Chicago. It's just two men broken, made in the image of God, crying out to God together. That's what lament is. That's the lament we need. We don't need the pontificators who stand up there and say, this is what we're going to do to fix this. We need to hear the voice of the alien and immigrant among us and raise up their stories. We need to hear the voice of the widows and the orphans among us and raise up their voices. I remember the next week, one of my dear brothers, Michael Sullivan, he had gone online, don't ask me how, he had gone online and learned how to say, my dear brother, I love you in Korean, and started the class off with Hyungnim Saranghaeyo, which literally means older brother, I love you. I remember William Jones, who was sentenced to death. And then when Illinois got rid of the death penalty, he was sentenced to life in prison. He has now been in prison for 45 years. He's 70 years old. Clearly rehabilitated, clearly corrected, according to the Department of Corrections. We'll never see the outside of those walls. But William took that and became a bishop to his community, and he is the bishop of that community. He is the spiritual leader. We all look towards William to be our spiritual guide. And about 2 weeks later, he said, I want you, when you stop by the guardhouse, I left something for you. And so we can put that up. It was a painting that he had done for me. And he said, I thought of you when I painted this. So apparently he thinks I'm a black man with an afro, because that's me in that painting. And he said, you are going to conquer the gates of hell. You're going through a rough time right now, but God will arm you and you'll be able to get through this. This is coming from a man who had once been sentenced to death row, who at the age of 70 is still incarcerated despite his rehabilitation and correction. And yet he's encouraging me to be strong in the Lord and to sustain and keep up the good fight. This is what it means to lament together, my dear brothers and sisters, to hear the stories of the alien and immigrant among us, to hear the stories of the widows and the orphans. May this church be that place that raises up these voices that are hurting in our world, and may that lament reach out to God, and may God respond to our cries. Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, call us into your place where we lament not just for our lives, but for the brokenness that is in our world. We ask this in your name. Amen.